Those were the formalities. Now let's get on with the debate, starting with Bill Gertz. Over to you.
The question before the House is a booming China, does a booming China spell trouble for America? The answer, in my view, is a resounding yes. In the next few minutes, I'm going to explain why. But first, what I call the China threat, which is something that Beijing likes to refer to as the China threat theory, is in fact real. It is a danger, and it is growing. As the late CIA analyst and White House National Security Council official Constantine Menges put it in his book, China, the Gathering Threat, he said the reason that China poses a threat is because, despite its economic reforms, it is today ruled by a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship. This is the source of the trouble. I've identified what I call 11 sources of trouble for the United States from China, and I'm going to list them for you and then talk briefly with the time remaining in some detail on them. The first is China's military buildup. Number two is the danger of war over Taiwan. Number three is expansionism over energy resources. Number four is the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and missiles. Number five is massive intelligence operations to steal U.S. secrets and technology. Number six is influence operations and so-called money diplomacy. Number seven is unfair trade practices, including currency valuation manipulation. Number eight, intellectual property theft. Number nine, human rights abuses. Number 10, religious repression. And number 11, environmental degradation and global warming. To start with, the most serious trouble for America from China is China's military buildup. On January 11th of this year, China conducted an unprecedented anti-satellite missile test. They fired a missile that traveled through space and hit a low Earth orbit satellite, a Chinese weather satellite, destroying it and creating 16,000 pieces of debris, which pose a threat to other satellites. U.S. officials were shocked by this development because U.S. intelligence estimates of China's military have been stating for years that China is 10, 15, maybe 20 years behind the United States, that it is so far behind that there is no way China's military could pose a threat. What the Chinese ASAT test showed was that China is not seeking to follow the U.S. missile for missile, ship for ship, submarine for submarine. They're going after niche weapons. They're trying to leap ahead with special technology. And they're doing this in a number of key areas, one of which is anti-satellite weapons. Officials in Washington estimate that by within the next 6 years, China will have the capability of destroying all U.S. low Earth orbit satellites. Basically, this could be the modern-day equivalent of a space Pearl Harbor against the United States if there were a conflict over Taiwan. Regarding Taiwan, the danger of war over the Taiwan Strait continues. China has not renounced its plan to use force to retake the island. It is applying pressure across the board to pressure this democracy. It is succeeding in many ways to influencing U.S. policy in ways that would diminish support for this traditional ally. The danger of China expanding to gain resources is kind of a new source of trouble that has been identified by some studies in the Pentagon, one of which was called the so-called String of Pearls strategy. It shows that China is developing a string of pearls, bases, alliances, along a path going from the Middle East, where much of its oil comes from, all the way to China. There are very much concerns that because energy is so integral to China's modernization effort, that China at some point will have to expand militarily, perhaps the Russian Far East, perhaps Southeast Asia, to take over places that have valuable oil and gas resources. Intelligence operations. This is a subject that I've focused on in my recent book. It also highlights the case of Chi Mak, who was a Chinese intelligence agent recently convicted in California of being an unregistered agent of the Chinese government. It's part of a mushrooming spy case, more of which will be coming out in the coming weeks and months. which shows that China has been very successful in stealing some of the most advanced U.S. weapons technology, including the next generation quiet electric drive for our warships, secrets about our submarine force, and as well as the Aegis battle management system, which is the heart of the modern Navy. As for influence operations, this is another area where China has been extremely successful in influencing policies against the United States. We see this through so-called, what one Chinese defector called, money diplomacy, buying up former U.S. officials and using those officials to lobby against policies that China doesn't like. This is having a deleterious effect on the U.S. economy and U.S. policy because it's preventing the United States from truly understanding the directions and goals of China's military modernization and its general modernization as well. Representative Randy Forbes, the chairman of the China caucus in the House of Representatives, estimates that China spends upwards of $100 million annually on these influence operations. Unfair trade practices and currency issues, as well as intellectual property theft, these issues are fairly well known, but I would like to highlight one issue surrounding the whole trade question. The main policy for the United States towards China has been to trade with China as a way to seek a liberalized Chinese government and political system. Unfortunately, the idea of trading with China as a liberalizing factor is not working. In fact, just the opposite is happening. Many feel that China's buildup, its military buildup, is being benefited by its economic growth, but yet we have seen little or no political reform in China. This is a very serious source of trouble for the United States. On human rights abuses, I would also point out how, at its core, China has never fully resolved the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, when pro-democracy protesters occupied the square. As well, religious repression is also in this field, as well as environmental degradation. As many as 7 out of 10 Chinese major rivers are now dead. This debate has often been couched as is between engagement and containment, but really the issue here is that what China needs is democracy, and that is really the solution to mitigating these sources of trouble for the United States.
Bill Gertz, many thanks indeed. A model of timeliness. Now, to stand against the motion, beware the dragon, a booming China spells trouble for America, I call upon Stapleton Roy.
Good evening. Let me begin with a dangerous confession. I love Fu Manchu novels. I've read them all. I've seen every movie version that I can get my hands on. Nothing sends shudders up my spine so much as contemplating sinister Chinese scheming to control the world. So when I was confronted with the question of whether a booming China spells trouble for the United States, my natural instinct was to think of Fu Manchu and to give a resounding yes. But then I remembered that I majored in history in college, not in the world's great literature. When you look at what's happening in China in terms of history and not in terms of fantasy fiction, you're forced to a very different conclusion. I grew up in wartime China. I was in China as a high school student at the time of the Communist Revolution in 1949. I visited China 3 times during the turmoil of the Cultural Revolution. When I visit China now, the situation is so different and so much better than China was in those days. Nevertheless, the question before you is a serious one. Any country of 1.3 billion people can spell trouble for us or for the global system. I have dealt with China professionally for over 30 years. It has been troublesome throughout that period. Our relations have improved. We have done well. But this is true that China can cause trouble, whether it's in boom or bust. A China that is floundering with a sense of grievance against the world and disaffected with the international system would be a greater danger than a booming China that can feed and clothe its people, educate them domestically and abroad, buy vast amounts of U.S. goods and services, and benefit from the international system. That's a far preferable outcome. Can we handle China's troublesome aspects? Of course we can. We're the world's premier military power. We have the largest and most productive economy in the world. We're improving our military technology at a rate faster than China is. We're a global leader in science and technology. Our schools and graduate schools are the envy of the world. The one requirement for handling any trouble that China causes is that we manage our domestic and international affairs so that we don't squander the enormous advantages that we have. Remember, trouble for us spells even bigger trouble for China. The advantage is on our side, not China's. 7 successive U.S. presidents over a space of 35 years have discovered that containing troubles and developing common interests with China benefits us. 3 successive generations of Chinese leaders have come to the same conclusion. Such a track record should give us confidence. What's more, experience over the last 15 years of China's rapid growth shows clearly that a booming China offers enormous opportunities for the United States and holds out the prospect of positive change in the future. China's rapid growth has created an enormous middle class concentrated in China's coastal provinces. This new middle class enjoys a level of affluence unthinkable in the 1970s. These middle class Chinese are educated, entrepreneurial, and outward looking. They have more in common with the middle classes elsewhere in Asia than they have with the backward parts of their own country. They represent the building blocks for China's eventual transition to a more representative form of government. China's society is remarkably more open than it was before. Hundreds of thousands of China's best and brightest have been sent to the West and primarily to the United States to study, to work, and to spend years here. Western-educated Chinese now occupy significant positions at all levels of government, business, and education in China, totally absent 30 years ago. In essence, China has abandoned Marxism-Leninism and class struggle in favor of market economics and promotion of a harmonious society. Obviously, as China's economy continues to grow and as its military capabilities improve, we have to consider the possibility that a more powerful and prosperous China will become a security threat. A highly nationalistic China under poor leaders or under bad leaders would pose serious problems for us and for the global community. 2 aspects are of particular concern. China's military spending has been growing at double-digit rates for the last 15 years. China's defense forces are preparing for Taiwan scenarios that include the possibility of U.S. intervention. Does this mean we should sound the alarms and assume that conflict with China is inevitable over Taiwan? The answer is no. The situation calls for vigilance, not for alarm. U.S. military leaders are not sitting on their thumbs. They are constantly improving our force posture. They are quietly confident that we can handle any challenges, and they believe that conflict can be avoided. Such confidence is warranted. We in China have developed an effective framework for managing the Taiwan issue. Both countries, the United States and China, have stated that they are opposed to unilateral changes in the status quo with respect to Taiwan. In addition, enormous common interests have developed on both sides of the Taiwan Strait, interests missing before we befriended China. Taiwan has poured over $100 billion of investment into the mainland. Millions of Taiwanese visit the mainland. Taiwan exports more across the Taiwan Straits now than it does to the United States. In the meantime, Taiwan runs its own affairs, it elects its own presidents, and it benefits from membership in the World Trade Organization and in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. In per capita GDP terms, Taiwan ranks just behind the European Union and ahead of countries such as Spain, New Zealand, and South Korea. It would require ineptitude on a massive scale in Beijing, Washington, and Taipei for this situation to generate into a military conflict. To conclude, an alarmist view of China exaggerates the dangers and obscures the opportunities. China's economy is now 10 times larger than it was in 1978, and our relations with China are better. And China has significant defense liabilities. Its most modern advanced military equipment comes from Russia, an unreliable source. After years of rapid growth, China now in defense spending, China now spends approximately the same percentage of GDP that we do, but its GDP is much smaller than ours. Its defense budget is less than half of the combined defense budgets of the UK, France, Germany, and Italy, all part of the European Union with a common defense policy. My experience in Asia has made me an optimist. I lived in Taiwan under an authoritarian regime. It's now a thriving democracy. I lived in Thailand twice under military-dominated governments, only to see it move to, for a period, to thriving parliamentary democracy. I was in Indonesia when an authoritarian government gave way. To sum up, the troubles produced by China booming are manageable, the opportunities are encouraging, the outlook is hopeful, if we display the traditional qualities that made us a great country.
And the speech is coming to a close.
Dragons are mythological beasts.
Thank you very much. This debate will be retitled Beware the Moderator. We now turn to Michael Pillsbury, who is going to speak for the motion.
Thank you very much. As all of you know, here in sophisticated New York, State Department and Defense Department often don't get along. So it may come as a surprise to you. It certainly comes as a surprise to me that I agree with every word of what Stapleton Roy just said. In fact, I believe our team wants to adopt him as a fourth member of our team because he essentially is speaking in favor of the motion as we see it. And I want to ask for your support for the motion. In the way we define the two key words in the motion, the first word is beware, and we take that to mean be wary, be wary. The second key word, Bill Gertz went over 11 examples, is trouble, spells trouble. In other words, the burden on the other team to earn your vote is to say you should not beware, you should be blithely sort of confident that there'll be no problems at all with China. They have to sustain that case. Then they have to sustain the case that there'll be no trouble from China forever. It seems to me it should be unanimous tonight that our team is going to win, especially since Stapleton Roy essentially is working for us. I do want to say he characterized the Defense Department's view of China quite correctly. That's very accurate. Going back for 15 years now, Secretaries of Defense and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs have said over and over and over that China is not a threat to the United States. In fact, often they embellish and say China for the foreseeable future will not be a threat. So that's the public position of the Pentagon. It's not looking for a war. There's a very high level of confidence that we would prevail in any conflict with China. And what you actually get is a series of factual reports each year that come out that list the 11 examples of trouble that Bill Gertz gave as factual matters. But Mr. Roy, Ambassador Roy is correct that there's a sense of confidence and not seeking any sort of conflict from China in the Pentagon. There's also a sense of that China is not a threat. And frankly, I have, since we're telling autobiographical stories, I've had about 35 years meeting with Chinese generals. From the first meeting up here in the United Nations, not far from here, all the way to last week when a delegation of generals was hosted by us in the Pentagon. Enormous changes have taken place, but not necessarily for the better. If you go back all the way to the beginning of the U.S. military relationship with the Chinese communists, it's really 1944 when we began to do some intelligence cooperation against the Japanese in the middle of World War II. That came out of something called the Dixie Mission that some of you, I think, in the audience look like you remember it. But 6 years later, we were at war with China. a tragic, tragic war, where the Chinese to this day claim they warned us. They use this strange phrase about we won't put our hands in our sleeves, and that was supposed to mean we're going to send 300,000 troops in and destroy American forces. We didn't understand it that way, and a tragic, avoidable war took place. 20 years of containment passed. Another cycle began of military cooperation between the U.S. and China. Our generals and theirs have met hundreds of times. We in the 80s, under President Reagan, who certainly would yield to nobody in his anti-communism, President Reagan authorized the sale of 6 American sophisticated weapon systems to China. It was again a peak, like 1944, when we were cooperating closely with the Chinese. You almost couldn't have had more security cooperation than we did under President Reagan with China. 3 years later, 1989, it had to all be canceled, and not far from here, out in Bethpage, Long Island, 2 Chinese jet fighters, sort of MiG-23 jet fighters, had to be crated up and sent back to China, and we refunded part of their money because of the Tiananmen incident and the heart-wrenching effect it had on American hopes for democracy and human rights in China. Then the last 15 or 16 years, there have been ups and downs, as Stapleton Roy correctly pointed out, but we've never gotten a pledge from China not to use force against Taiwan. We've never settled, we've never really gotten credit for what Henry Kissinger did. President Nixon withdrew American nuclear weapons from Taiwan. President Nixon severed the military connection. President Carter severed the fact that we kept 2 American generals there, one for arms supply, one to plan war with the defense of Taiwan in mind. The Chinese take that, those major concessions from us, as though they never happened. And the Chinese rhetoric today continues to talk about how the U.S., if it even sells one bullet to Taiwan, this somehow strengthens the independence forces on Taiwan. It's simply not true. We have enormous self-imposed restrictions on our arms sales to Taiwan. So across the board, we have a lack of progress in Chinese nationalistic attitudes toward America. If you pull out an average Chinese Youth Daily article today, and you look up what does it say about the United States, it's not very friendly. We have 15 major programs now in foreign aid, in helping their banking system through our Treasury Department. Our Labor Department has a mediation service going to help them with labor disputes. Every department of the U.S. government has what, in my view, amounts to an aid program, a program of engagement with China. Very seldom mentioned in the Chinese press. If you're a young Chinese, you have the impression that America is trying to dismember China, that America poses a military threat, that America is working with India and Japan to somehow crush China or contain its rise. All of this nationalistic rhetoric ought to be banned in the Chinese press. We don't say these things in our press, but it hasn't stopped. The worst was 1999, I might point out, when the front page of the Communist Party Daily, People's Daily, carried a long article called The 7 Ways America is Worse Than Nazi Germany. And it went into detail about which kind of gas the Nazis had used in their camps. And then there was a paragraph, I'll never forget it, saying the Americans are even worse than that. 1 minute. So, to support our side of this debate, you have to be wary. That is, look for possibilities that might happen in the future where things will not be as rosy as we may have hoped. And you have to admit there's trouble. That's all we ask for our side. And I hope it will be unanimous. But we don't have to be, our side doesn't have to be extreme. We don't have to be alarmist about China. We don't have to forecast an inevitable war. We don't have to say that we should break off all relations. I mentioned to you the 15 aid programs. I want to close my last sentence with just one of the most impressive to me. We have more than 50 agreements, governmental agreements, to transfer American scientific findings to China for free. Our National Science Foundation and our White House Office of Science and Technology Policy are in charge of this. The Chinese don't really make a big deal out of it, but it's an amazing program when you
Michael
think about
Pillsbury,
it.
Michael Pillsbury, I'm afraid your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now turn to Daniel Rosen, who is speaking against the motion.
Thank you very much, James, and it's a pleasure to be here this evening. I want to start by saying welcome to New York to those supporting tonight's proposition. While neocons and liberals alike down in the Beltway in Washington and from other places around the country debate the theory and these concepts of grand strategy to do with China, we here in New York have been working very, very hard, of course, in our many professions to try to understand the nature of its reform, its growth, and make sure that we benefit as a nation from what's the epic changes taking place in this country, making sure that we don't gauge China against the abject failures of 30, 40, 50 years ago, some of which have already been cited, but instead recognize that China is not at all standing still and is very much a work in progress. So I, for one, very much look forward to the chance to debate these issues here tonight. The notion that China's strengthening is bad news for us, which is really what we're talking about, of course. China's boom is essentially economic at its core. So the role that has been cast for me is to lay out three critical economic arguments for why, whether you're a New Yorker or not, you should be very much against the motion that we have on the table before us this evening. First argument, China's boom is benefiting others in a big way, not just China. Secondly, that its growth is very much helping its people, not repressing them, and thus mitigating in an important way many threats that we'd have to deal with if China were not growing. And thirdly, that we, the United States, together with China, have larger economic responsibilities of a global nature that demand our mutual respect and our enthusiasm, in fact, instead of confrontation with China over its growth and strengthening, which indeed is what we're here to debate. Let me explain each of these very briefly. First of all, China's growth is benefiting the economies of rich and poor nations alike. Japan, with merely 40% of the labor force that the United States has, exports $10 billion worth of goods to China every month. The United States only exports half that amount. Germany, with a mere one-quarter of our labor force, has run a net trade surplus with China over the period 1992 to today. The point of this is China is not an economy that is closed to rich world exports at all. It's very much open to them. Developing nations in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, in Africa are also benefiting in a way the World Bank couldn't have imagined a few years ago from China's dynamic growth. It's embracing China as a new destination for exports. Even Taiwan, that's of such concern to us all here at this table, is in fact enjoying a $66 billion a year trade surplus with its arch enemy, the People's Republic of China, a trade surplus which has grown from 14 to 40% every year of this decade so far. Taiwan, in fact, is moving away from the attitude behind the motion on the table this evening, away from confrontation and toward working out of things in a peaceable manner, deepening and integrating its economy with the mainlands. Bottom line, our fortunes here depend on what we do, on how we compete with China, not on what China does. We should spend more time competing with Germany and Japan, in fact, for the Chinese market, and less time blaming China for all of our troubles. Of course, the United States is already a major beneficiary of China's economic activity. If we cut off all trade with China tomorrow, we would create very few American jobs. We would import practically everything we import from China, but from other countries at a higher price, which wouldn't really benefit anybody in this country. Second major argument I want to make, China's growth benefits its people, and by doing so, mitigates profound troubles that would eventuate if that were not the case. The real threats, the existential threats to the United States today come from impoverished and stagnant states riven by discontent and insecurity. North Korea, Iran, Iraq, the Middle East in general. Stagnant economic circumstances in Sudan, in Venezuela. These are the engines that breed terrorism and nihilism, which are the true threat and trouble we should be concerning ourselves with. China could have been among those In fact, the China of 1978, before the dreaded boom that we're here to debate this evening, would have been one of those. By embracing our economic model, in fact, which is what they've done, they've grown beyond that danger. And though 800 million Chinese are still poor by our standards, they're striving toward prosperity and not toward extremism. Those people, those toiling Chinese, are the boom that we're here to pass judgment on this evening. And while their toil brings competitive challenges for us, we would be gravely mistaken to try to turn back the clock to the failed state China was before this boom began. Prosperity is not an alternative to political change in China. In fact, it's been the handmaiden of it. The totalitarian government ruling $200 per capita China in 1978 bears practically no resemblance to the Chinese government managing a $2,000 per capita economy today. Likewise, the Chinese government that runs $10,000 per capita China tomorrow will be vastly different than the one we deal with today. Third major argument. Beyond our narrow economic interests and theirs lie global economic responsibilities that must be addressed cooperatively. Tonight we're debating whether the benefits of a stronger China are worth the trouble it brings us along the way, or rather, whether the troubles of a stagnant China would suit our interests better. Because that's really the question. It's which set of troubles suits the American interest and which does not. It's a reasonable question. But such a narrow-minded calculus of self-interest alone does not befit a great power and certainly does not befit the United States. Economic success, foremost ours, and now China's as well, is creating a great economic, political, and indeed security challenge, climate change and environmental crisis globally. The U.S. has refused to address its responsibility to carbon emissions, and the reason given, China. A convenient fits-all purposes excuse not to act when you don't want to act. China, interestingly enough, has refused to accept carbon commitments for the same reason. The United States should go first. This logjam is fueled by the mistrust that tonight's motion puts forward. And indeed, it cannot be permitted to stand. We have an economic responsibility to the planet to deal with this together, or we're going to lose more than anybody does. To finish, let me say this. I have a private practice, in addition to being a think tanker and professor, and my customers are troubles. They're troubles I'd like to have more of, frankly. I don't have a problem with troubles. We have more troubles with Canada economically than we do with any other country. Is that bad news for the United States? It's not. It's part of a mature relationship. Those in favor of tonight's motion counsel a strategy meant to leave China in ruins, using a playbook last used in the Cold War, building up our military instead of our economy. Who will join us in such a strategy? I urge you to vote against tonight's motion. The troubles of a stagnant, unbooming China far, far outweigh the challenges of its growth. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I turn to John Mearsheimer, the last speaker, for the motion. Beware the dragon, a booming China spells trouble for America.
Okay. The question on the table is, does a rising China spell trouble for the United States? Or in slightly different words, from an American perspective, is a powerful China likely to be bad for the United States? I think the answer is axiomatically yes. And I say this not because I feel any personal hostility towards the Chinese, which I certainly don't, or because I think China is particularly aggressive because it was or is a communist country, or it is run in an authoritarian political form. I think that matters very little. And I don't say it because I think China is likely to behave irrationally in the future. My argument is that the best situation for the United States from the perspective of maximizing its security is to be the most powerful state in the international system. The bigger the gap between you and everybody else, the more secure you are. To put it in Pentagonese, you don't want a peer competitor in the international system. To give you two examples that highlight this point, think about the United States and its two immediate neighbors, Canada and Mexico. As you know, we are much more powerful than either one of those countries. None of you go to bed at night worrying about Canada or Mexico attacking the United States tomorrow, next week, or next year. That's simply not going to happen because we're so powerful. Would you trade the present situation for one where Canada and Mexico, or Canada or Mexico, was twice as powerful as the United States? Of course you wouldn't. It's much better to have a situation where we are the most powerful state in the Western Hemisphere. Same basic logic applies to China. If China has two choices, one, it can have a Japan in Asia that's five times more powerful than China, or a situation where China is five times more powerful than Japan, which one of those alternatives do you think the Chinese will choose? It's an open and shut case. They'd much prefer to be five times more powerful. And the same basic argument applies to the United States and China, today, tomorrow, or at any point in time. If you have a choice of being as powerful or less powerful than China, or being more powerful, which would you choose if you're interested in maximizing your security? An open and shut case. Let me spell out the logic that underpins my argument. Principal goal of any state in the international system, it's not the only goal, but the principal goal is survival. And the reason is if you don't survive, you can't pursue any other goals. The problem that states have is they operate in an anarchic system. That's political science speak for saying that they operate in a system where there's no higher authority that you can turn to if you get into trouble. In other words, if you dial 911 in a crisis in international politics, there's nobody at the other end. In a system like that, where you're dealing with other states whose intentions you can never be certain of, and you want to understand here that it's impossible for the United States to discern what Chinese intentions will be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. We don't know what those intentions will be. In a system where you can't discern intentions and where there is no higher authority that you can turn to when you're in trouble, the best way to maximize your chances of surviving is to make sure that you are by far the most powerful state in the international system. To put it in colloquial terms, you want to be the biggest and baddest dude on the block, so that nobody fools around with you. To put it in political science speak, you want to be a hegemon. Now the question is, what does the system look like today? The situation today from an American point of view is ideal. We are by far the most powerful state on Earth. We dominate the Western Hemisphere. There's no state in our region of the world that could possibly challenge us. We have tremendous power projection capabilities, which is why we're called the only superpower in the world. And in Asia and in Europe, the two areas of the world where there are other great powers or potential great powers, we have no peer competitor. There's no Imperial Japan, there's no Imperial Germany, there's no Nazi Germany, and there's no Soviet Union. From an American point of view, that's a wonderful situation. Now, what is the future going to look like if in, say, 20 years, China continues to grow economically the way it has grown over the past 20 years? What you're going to get is a country that's economically pretty close to being as strong as the United States. And you can rest assured that China's going to turn that economic might into military might. They'd be foolish if they didn't. You'll then have a country that's roughly the military equivalent of the United States, or at least close to it. That country is going to try to dominate Asia the way the United States has successfully dominated the Western Hemisphere. They'd be fools to do otherwise. Do you think the founding fathers and their successors in this country were fools because they attempted to establish and did establish hegemony in the Western Hemisphere? Of course not. They did it for good security reasons. The Asians will do the same. The Chinese will do the same thing in Asia. We have a Monroe Doctrine here in the United States. Most of you know it very well. We basically tell the European and Asian great powers that they have to stay out of our hemisphere. We don't want them here. Don't you think the Chinese are going to feel the same way in Asia when they're powerful enough to think about dominating Asia? Furthermore, they're going to dominate, develop significant power projection capability, just like we have developed significant power projection capability. They're going to develop a blue water navy, and that navy is going to be designed to go into the Middle East, much the way our navy is designed to go in the Middle East. When I was a young boy, my mother used to say to me, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If it's good for the United States, why don't you think it'll be good for China to try and dominate Asia and to try and develop significant power projection capability. Of course, this all raises the question, then, how is the United States likely to react? It's very simple. We have a clear record here on how we react when other countries try to dominate either Europe or Asia. We go to great lengths to stop them. Imperial Germany, Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, and the former Soviet Union. They're all on the scrap heap of history, and we played a key role in putting them there. The United States will not tolerate a situation where China tries to dominate Asia. And as I said, China will try to dominate Asia, just the way the United States has tried to dominate and has succeeded at dominating the Western Hemisphere. What is my bottom line here? My bottom line is straightforward. The present situation is better for the United States and more stable than a world in which China is as powerful or almost as powerful as the United States. In other words, if China rises, trouble is in store for the United States. Thank you.
John Mearsheimer, thank you very much. And now, finally, Jim McGregor speaking against the motion.
Well, my name is Jim McGregor, and I've lived in China for 20 years, and I'm just grateful that I did not make Bill Gertz's list of 11 threats from China. It's kind of intimidating being here among all these PhDs and well-studied men. I ended up in China because I was expelled from high school. I joined the Army when I got expelled from high school. They sent me to Vietnam. That turned my head towards Asia. It led to me becoming a journalist, and as time went on, I wanted to get back to Asia as a journalist, so I went to China in 85 and backpacked through the country. 87, I moved to Taiwan to learn Mandarin, and I've lived in Beijing since 90, both as a journalist and a business person. All of the theories that I've heard tonight, I've read many times. My view is more kind of grassroots, what China looks like on the ground and what I've seen. When I first moved to China as a reporter, I had secret police following. My phone was tapped. Even the maid who took care of our nanny, who helped us with our daughter, was from the foreign ministry and made reports on us. This was a country that was just really emerging from the forest fire of the Cultural Revolution. And what I've seen since then has been kind of documented by other speakers here tonight on the fast growth. I mean, I've watched the first financial person I met in China was a guy named Millions Yang, who was a steel worker who had cornered the market on the four stocks on the illegal Shanghai stock market. And now China's doing the world's largest IPOs, and in fact, Chinese stocks were the top performers on NASDAQ last year. When I first got to Beijing in the fall, you had big piles of cabbage on the corner because that was the only vegetable they got. People would bring it home, they'd shove it under their bed or into cabinets, and over the winter you'd tear away the rotten leaves and you could eat the fresh leaves inside. Well, as you know now, if I don't see a new high-rise every day, I get a little jittery. It's moving so fast. International sophistication. When I went there in 85, people would come up to me on the street and show me around for the day because they were so excited to learn about the outside world. Well, we've had 600,000 students alone from China come to the United States. Chinese people are very international, traveling the world, doing business, and even being involved in academic endeavors in the United States. So we've learned that China's a very formidable country tonight, and we better be scared of them. Because why? Well, China has grown very fast, and it's moving very fast, but what has happened during this period? China has been shoving all kinds of problems under the carpet. The carpet's getting lumpy, and the country will trip on these problems, and it's going to be very busy for the next few decades fixing this. Environment, China is trash. 16 of the 20 worst air-polluted cities in the world are in China. I've traveled in every province of China, and I've never seen a clean body of water that was not in a bottle. Healthcare, from a fairly decent basic healthcare system, it's become very commercial. Two-thirds of people don't have health care. If you are a peasant and your kid gets cancer, what do? You beg, borrow, and steal money to get him to a hospital in a city. You have to deposit the money for your kid to be in that hospital. If you run out of money, they kick your kid out of that hospital. The have and the have-not issue is growing and growing. There was 80,000 demonstrations 2 years ago. Last year they went down because they realized they better not be reporting on how many they had. And on, party corruption, etc. So this is this colossus that's going to take on the United States. What does China really want? From a military standpoint, China wants to protect its wealth. It's been a country that's been colonized. It also wants to have the military projection to be able to protect it, protect its own sea lanes. From natural resources, China, the rocks have not been kind to China. They're as dependent as we are or more on imported oil and other and iron ore and other raw materials. The government is running scared of its own people. You've got to realize when you have 10% economic growth for 20 years and kids are growing up under that kind of growth, they expect exponential improvement every year forever. And the government has really no credibility other than economic growth and giving people a better life. So where does the United States have to worry? Where do we really eclipse China? You can't be a global leader without a leading ideology, and China right now has no leading ideology other than getting rich. Right now, the United States isn't so popular around the world with Iraq and other issues. China is outworking the world. But I tell you, people are looking for U.S. leadership. We will not have trouble competing with China diplomatically. Financial world, New York, you can walk down the street here and throw a rock in any direction. You're going to hit $1 trillion in hedge funds. The Shanghai banks still don't have check clearing mechanisms for private accounts. China's moving ahead in the financial world. They've got $1 trillion foreign exchange surplus, and they're, in fact, putting together a $120 billion hedge fund. But they are going to have to be dependent on the U.S. and our financial system and cooperating with us for their money to be deployed well as the capital they need. Education. China's built 700 universities in the last 15 years. However, it still has stuffed duck style education where people are taught to memorize, not to think for themselves, and not to analyze. The world comes to America as long as we give them the visas to have the best in the world education system. We can absorb the brains of the world and stay ahead of anybody in the world. Finally, I'm looking at my opponents here. I'm on the good guys team here on the left, and my opponents here, these are all learned men, they're all PhDs, but take a look, there's not a bit of suntan on any of those heads. They have been sitting in offices in Washington and Chicago, reading reports and putting together the world under theories, and that's quite good. I'm happy to say that. And I'm not here to defend China. I'm here to defend America, because if you say that we can't handle the rise of China, then you are voting against America tonight. I believe that you really have to vote no, because if you vote yes, then you're voting against America. America can handle the rise of China. China's got a lot of problems, and we've handled many things in the life of this country, and we will handle this quite well. Thank you very much.
Jim McGregor, thank you very much. Now, before we turn to the Q&A part of the evening, I just wanted to let you know how you all voted before the debate began. Before the debate, and I'll just remind you, the motion is Beware the Dragon, a Booming China Spells Trouble for America. Before the debate began, you voted 41.05% of you. 41% of you voted for the motion. 37.4% voted against the motion, and 21.5% said you were undecided. So quite a thin margin for the sun-drenched team against the motion to sway there. Before we get started, I thought I'd abuse my position as a moderator here to just ask a couple of questions. And I guess I wanted to start by directing a question at John Mearsheimer. You couldn't help but feel that Michael Pillsbury gave the game away a little bit when he said, you know, on our side of the motion, we don't need to be alarmist. We don't need to talk about war. And yet, within a few minutes' time, you were saying, the U.S. will not tolerate a situation where China tries to dominate Asia. And I guess my question is to you, how does China have a hope of fulfilling its promise of a peaceful rise if people like you are standing up and saying, we will not tolerate China that seeks to dominate the region in which it lives. Is this not just warmongering that is dressed as prudence? And I have a question I also... I have a question also for Stapleton Roy, which is, listening to you, you can't help but fear that your position is don't worry, be happy. We have a politically unstable superpower with a foreign policy that is unclear even to itself. And clearly that is going to, at the very least, threaten U.S. preeminence in the world. And I guess my question to you is, looking back over the last 30 years, even if you take into account the benefits of engagement, has not commercial engagement with China made it more difficult for the U.S. to engage on issues from Tibet to Taiwan? And how much will the U.S. be forced to compromise its foreign policy positions if it is going to ignore the threat that China poses? So first to Professor Mearsheimer.
The question of whether or not China can rise peacefully is a somewhat different question than the one that is on the table. And there's no question, as our moderator said, that I bumped into the question of whether China can rise peacefully. Now, he said, in effect, R and I creating a self-fulfilling prophecy here, because China wants to rise peacefully in his story, but yet the United States, because it's being prudent, is creating a situation where you'll have a clash down the road. It's not necessary that you'll have a shooting war, but you'll certainly have an intense security competition as a result of my story. There's no question about that with the possibility of war. My argument is that the United States really has no choice, because as China gets more and more powerful economically, the United States constantly bumps into the question of what China's intentions will be 10, 20, or 30 years down the road. And he says, the moderator, that China wants to rise peacefully. But he can't assure me that China wants to rise peacefully or will rise peacefully. There's just no way of knowing. And in a world where you have a state that's becoming increasingly powerful, nearly as powerful as you, you have to assume worst case about its intentions to protect yourself in case there is trouble. Because as I said to you before, if you do get into trouble, there's no 911 that you can appeal to. And in a very important way, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is why I titled the book that I wrote on this subject, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. This is a tragic situation. The United States simply has no choice but to assume the worst about China, and the end result is that you'll get that for sure.
And on that happy note, Stapleton Roy.
I spent my career as a diplomat, and somehow the world wasn't this Hobbesian picture that has been presented to us. Just think about it for a moment. If your goal is to keep everybody else down, you shouldn't be surprised to discover that nobody else shares that goal. Now, successful foreign policies are based on finding common interests with other countries, not in trying to keep them down. If we try to keep China down, we'll have to keep India down or whoever the next person is. What kind of a foreign policy and what kind of a country are we if that's our approach? Think of it another way. If our goal is to ensure the security and prosperity of the American people in a world in which other countries have an equal right, if they can do so responsibly, to improve the prosperity and security of their people, then we have a world in which there are common goals and which other countries can also raise the living standards of their people and meet their security needs better. The goal then of our foreign policy is responsible behavior in the international community. That's a shared goal with most other countries, and it's an achievable goal. But it requires that we also set a good example. Now remember also, the Western Hemisphere is the only region of the world in which one power can be the hegemon. China is surrounded by Japan, that has a conventional military capable that's the equal of China's. It's surrounded by Russia, a nuclear power, by India, a nuclear power, by Vietnam, which is no patsy, by Korea, which is no patsy, and the United States is a permanent factor in the region. Chinese leaders do not spend their time thinking about dominating Asia through power. The way that they are increasing their influence is through influence. They're reassuring their neighbors They're behaving in a way which leads the Southeast Asian countries in the lead in promoting an East Asian community, not China. So it's the country that throws its weight around that loses influence, and the country that uses its influence to promote its interests that is doing so more effectively. We ought to learn something from this. We are actually very good at playing this game when we realize that we cannot accomplish our goals or keep a peaceful world if we rely on power, as opposed to the right balance of power and influence. We certainly need to keep ourselves strong enough so a rising China does not threaten our prosperity and our security. But we don't need to do so in a world where we have to keep everybody else down because of a threat to our hegemonic position.
Thank you.
May I just say, I still consider Ambassador Roy to be the fourth member of our team. thank you very much for those comments. A balance of power is, in fact, the right approach.
Michael Pillsbury is being a dissident within the process. We need to keep the lines of the left and right absolutely clear here. Now, we get to the interesting bit, which is over to you. What I'd like to do is ask you to come forth with questions. For the panel, please make clear who you're directing them to. Please, if you wouldn't mind, stand up when you ask a question. If you're a member of the press, would you say so? And would you identify yourself? And one final thing, would you do what I didn't, which is keep your questions short and succinct? Right, there are two people here. There are people with mics. Two up at the front here. Thank you very much. This lady right in the middle.
My name is Lily Bloomberg. For John Mearsheimer, you say that we should want to maintain superiority to China, but just as the part of the fabric of America, shouldn't we also want to concern ourselves with the human rights and the conditions in China?
John Mearsheimer, if you don't mind, we're going to take a couple of questions, two or three together, and then we're going to go on. Thank you very much. Sorry, there's a gentleman over here who has a question.
My name is Mike Endicott. This question is for Daniel Rosen. Does the example of Hong Kong and China's behavior towards Hong Kong give us any clear picture of their future intentions?
Thank you very much. Let's start with those two. John Mearsheimer, should we not pay more attention to human rights than just our own interests?
The point that I tried to make in my comments was that a state can have a variety of different interests, and promoting human rights or protecting human rights and promoting democracy can be and often are legitimate goals of states, especially the United States. But the highest goal always has to be protecting your security, maintaining your survival. And the point that I tried to make clear here is that the best way to maximize your chances of surviving in the system are to make sure that you are by far the most powerful state, because then nobody can fool around with you. And once you have ensured your survival, you're, of course, then free to pursue those other goals.
Thank you. Daniel Rosen, what does Hong Kong tell us?
Hong Kong tells us a lot. The motion we're debating tonight with regard to the meta-phenomenon of China's strengthening and coming back into a position of relative strength after a century of relative weakness, could easily have been debated in the more narrow context of Hong Kong 10 years ago, about 10 years ago today, in fact, almost, or a month away. People assumed that China's reassumption of control over Hong Kong would necessarily bring a cauldron of concerns and troubles about Hong Kong's fate. In fact, things have played out entirely differently than that. China has left Hong Kong to manage its own affairs in the same way that Beijing, to a great extent, is allowing many regions of the country within mainland China to manage their own affairs. Probably too much so. We probably need a stronger Beijing rather than a weaker one, in fact. Hong Kong is prospering. Its success or failure stands on its own competitiveness. This is precisely what we should learn from the situation. Hong Kong can do better or worse. It has less to do with Beijing than it does to do with Hong Kong. the United States can benefit or be at a relative loss as a result of China's economic growth. It has everything to do with the choices we make and how we choose to respond instead of trying to adjust our game to respond to what China wants to do instead.
Thank you very much. Right, yeah, the two gentlemen just up there. Let's take a couple of questions from you two, please. And then, there's someone right up at the back. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Orstrom. Given Frédéric Bastiat's empirically proven statement, where goods cross borders, armies won't, I'd like to ask the friendly Mr. Pillsbury if he truly believes that a wealthy China poses a greater threat to America and to the world and to the region than an impoverished China. Others, I think Mr. Mearsheimer clearly answered that question. I'd like to get your direct answer.
Thank you very much. So the gentleman at the back.
Hi. I guess this is for Mr. Mearsheimer. He was saying that the military strength is the key to controlling China, but it seems that we can't really do anything in Iraq to control Iraq. How are we ever going to control China? And really, economically, since they have trillions of dollars pouring into their country and we're running a major, major deficit, how would we ever possibly finance a military that could overcome China? I mean, they have so much more money in the bank now, and it seems like in the foreseeable future that's going to be the case. So shouldn't we focus on being economic partners with them and trading partners, as Ambassador Roy said, and seek common ground rather than sort of pursue this military concept, which isn't working anywhere for us?
Thank you. And the gentleman here in the bow tie, please.
My question also is to Mr. Mearsheimer. sorry to pile on you, but why do you believe, contrary to every example in recorded history, that the United States can continue to be the most powerful nation in the world? And in what way are the citizens of those countries which used to be the most powerful nations in the world, Sweden, the Netherlands, Great Britain, any worse off now that they are no longer citizens of the most powerful nation in the world?
Thank you for that very understanding question. let's start first, though, with a question for Michael Pillsbury about a wealthy China surely being better for America and the world than an impoverished one.
I prefer a wealthy China to a poor, angry China. I think the issue, though, is not wealth.
Just joined our side.
It's an even trade.
State Department's always seeking new allies. I think the issue is really democracy. And a wealthy, democratic China is a better partner for us, a better ally, a better friend than even a poor democratic China. The problem is how to get from here to there without being foolishly naive in building up China's economic strength in a way that they also maintain their nationalism, they maintain their anti-American views, and the situation ends up that we have been gullible and naive over a 15 or 20 year period. And this has happened before. If you read John Mearsheimer's most recent book, it really chronicles a number of times this has happened in world politics. So if you really want to support our side of the resolution, you need to be thinking about this phrase the moderator used, which I love. I think he's working for us too. Don't worry, be happy. Because that's what their side really is advocating. I am saying be wary in the following four or five ways. We need to continue our military exchange program with the Chinese military and let them see that we're not their enemy. We don't want to call that off because don't worry, be happy. We need to continue the embargo on arms sales to China. We shouldn't sell weapons to China. We should continue our support that the European Union has its embargo on arms sales to China until human rights improves significantly. We should continue to do something about Taiwan's defense. We don't have to arm them to the teeth, but we shouldn't just walk away from Taiwan. And finally, we need to have technology limits on our most advanced technology that we transfer to China. Right now, it's very generous, but there are a few things we hold back, And some people say that was part of their successful test against a satellite in space, is that they had some Western technology at their service. And frankly, I don't know if all of you know, as perhaps as civilians, 90% of your military forces go through satellites, communications, intelligence. Also, every time you use an ATM card, that's a satellite-conveyed transaction. So we're a highly vulnerable society with our 400 satellites in space. This test is very serious in January, and the Chinese government, after repeated requests, has no explanation for it. They just say, oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry, be happy.
Thank you very much. We'll come back in one moment. Just to John Mearsheimer, could you take on both of those questions, essentially the question of whether or not American hegemony should or can afford to continue forever?
Yeah. Do you want to let Daniel?
No, go ahead. John Mearsheimer, and then we'll turn to Daniel Rosen in a moment.
Yeah. Very quickly on all three questions. The first one said where goods cross borders, armies don't. I think that's empirically wrong. And there was a tremendous amount of economic interdependence in Europe before World War I, and World War I still happened. And if you look at German-Soviet relations in 1941, there was actually a tremendous amount of economic intercourse, and yet you still had World War II. And in the Cold War, in fact, you had hardly any economic intercourse between the United States and the Soviet Union, and nevertheless, you never had a shooting war. Now, on the question of whether or not we could possibly contain China, which gets into the two other questions that I was asked, and the person pointed out, how could we possibly contain China when we can't even deal with Iraq? I would note that going to war in Iraq was a completely crazy idea from the beginning, and whether or not you can fight and win in Iraq is a very different issue than whether you can contain China down the road. And the analogy I would point to that makes this quite obvious is our experience in Vietnam and at the same time our experience containing and defeating the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The Vietnam War, like the Iraq War, was a completely cockamamie idea. But nevertheless, the United States, even though it lost in Vietnam, still won the Cold War. And there's no question that the United States should avoid fighting Iraqs down the road, but it clearly has the wherewithal to finance the defenses to contain China down the road. And this gets to the final question, which is, can the United States remain number one forever? And if we don't, will we be that badly off? First of all, nothing's forever, so the United States is not going to remain number one forever. But I would be willing to bet a lot of money that the United States is actually more powerful relative to the rest of the world over the course of this century, largely for demographic reasons, than it is right now. A lot of the doomsayers who say that the United States is in real trouble down the road are simply wrong, in my opinion. And I think a powerful case can be made, contrary to what we're talking about up here, that China won't rise anywhere near as much as many people think it will. Then getting to the final point, are we worse off, or would we be worse off not being so powerful? Look at the Europeans. Well, if you look at Europe in recent times, that's true. But let's go back to 1900 and think about being a Pole anywhere from 1900 to 2007. Think about growing up in France anytime between 1900 and 2007. Yeah, the last few decades have been pretty good. But if you look at the broader sweep of history, it looks mighty nasty. And who's to tell what the future looks like? Many of you assume that it's going to be peace, love, and dope forever, right? I mean, Europe has been pacified. War has been burned out of Europe. Maybe, maybe not. I'm just a very prudent person. I don't like to take chances. And that means that I just prefer to be much more powerful rather than as powerful as the other states in the system.
Right. Thank you very much, John Mearsheimer. A very quick response from Daniel Rosen.
This is going to start to sound like a George Bernard Shaw play, but I'm with Pillsbury. a wealthy democratic China is clearly in the U.S. interest. Be wary of arguments that you can foster democracy in China by stymieing the boom. A boom doesn't guarantee democratization. A bust guarantees that you will not get there. That can be said pretty clearly. And we already see early evidence of democratization processes starting to take place. People elect their own co-op boards. They decide who represents them in their parent-teacher associations in their schools. This is happening already, and everybody who spends time in China sees it manifestly.
Thank you very much. Right, a few more questions, and I don't want this New York audience to get a bad reputation, so if anyone wants to throw a punch at the side that's against the motion, please feel free. The gentleman here on the left.
I'll see what I can do. If we held this debate 20 years ago, you'd probably insert Japan for China at that time, and we see that that kind of played out a different way, despite what Michael Crichton might think. That said, how does Japan kind of enter into the debate here? I mean, if you think about it, there is some scholarship or some theory that suggests that we should think about Japan as a bulwark against rising China. And I'd like to get Fielder's choice from the panelists. How do you think Japan plays in, you know, in terms of the Constitution, in terms of rearmament? How can they play a constructive role in perhaps bringing some kind of accommodation in Asia?
Thank you very much. And the gentleman up there in the blue shirt.
Thanks. This is for the speakers against the motion. You had said that China has no ideology, and yet if a booming China means that U.S. is increasingly dependent on China, and yet China has shown its interest in supporting rogue or failed states such as Sudan, and yet because of our dependence on China, that inhibits our ability to intervene in those situations, how would you respond to that?
Thank you very much. We'll come to you in one moment. Let's start. Jim McGregor, do you want to deal with Japan, and who'd like to deal with China's role in Sudan? Let's start with Japan.
Well, no, I want to address where he talks about us being dependent on China. Who's dependent on whom here? Look at the no one's talking about the Chinese people and the economic ties. China's oil companies, China's banks, China's telecom companies are all listed on overseas stock exchanges. They're the second biggest buyers of U.S. treasuries. They're completely tied into us. We're not dependent on China in any way, shape, or form. We're tied together, which is for the common good. A country that is tied together that deeply and economically, and the amount of jobs that are created by the consumers in America, by the foreign companies, 60-some percent of exports from China come from foreign companies. So we're so intertwined, it just brings more stability.
But Jim McGregor, doesn't this question cut to exactly the problem? We're having two debates here this evening. On the right-hand side, you have people who are talking about foreign policy and national security. And on the left-hand side, we have people talking about economic growth and commercial opportunity. And actually, when you look at a case like Sudan, when you look at China's involvement in Zimbabwe, actually we're failing to address or engage China in constructive diplomatic work around the world.
Well, if you look at what have we done, China now is awash with money and they're looking to invest overseas. When they came to buy Unocal, which pumped, I think, 0.8% of American oil, Congress looked at this as a national security threat and pushed them away. You know, we've pushed Middle East money out of China, out of the U.S. already. They're going to China. China's now going out in the world to invest, and we're starting to push them away. This isn't the Philistines of the business community against the honorable people of the PhD world. This is commercial reality versus theory.
Thank you very much. A couple more questions. The lady up here on the right-hand side, Nalo, down here, and there's a gentleman in a mauve shirt in the middle.
Hi, my name is Jolie Hunt. This is for James McGregor. Speaking of commercial realities, I'm very surprised that censorship hasn't come up. Especially as we're against this motion. And it doesn't seem like we're comparing apples to apples here. It's more like bullets to grenades. And if we have to act like responsible citizens, how can we not pay attention when China doesn't? So the question comes to censorship and the notion that companies like Google and Yahoo have to make restrictions on news and information there, and how can we compete with them? And saying that America can take it seems to be rather naive.
You're not Thank you.
To answer that.
Hold one moment. And this gentleman here.
Hi, my name is John Silberman. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is for any one of the gentlemen against the motion. Here's my question. China's ability to produce goods for far less than America has caused untold numbers of our citizens to lose their jobs. Doesn't that mean that the China boom has already caused trouble for America?
Thank you very much. Who'd like to start with that question? Tim McGregor, do you want to talk about the outsourcing problem?
No, I'll talk about censorship because I'm out of the media.
Okay, you're going to dodge. Okay, let's start Daniel Rosen with outsourcing. And we're going to have to keep it relatively short, I'm afraid.
Right. The automobile industry was a terrible, terrible threat to the horse and buggy industry here in New York City. In fact, there's practically, we're down to about 100 people in horse and buggy now. They're all in Central Park. The U.S., unlike almost every other great power that we've seen, has shown itself entirely open to change, to adjustment. Instead of trying to defend an increasingly uncompetitive status quo, we've found ways to innovate, to adjust, to continue to be competitive, despite the changes that necessarily take place in the world around us today. Trouble is a given. Change is a given. It's unfortunate. It's difficult for people that are faced with the immediate consequences of it, but there's really very little alternative to it. Finally, we have a 4.5% unemployment rate in this country. How much lower do we really want it to go?
James, thank you.
On the commercial realities part, I'd like to get in a word there.
Sorry, Bill Gertz, yes.
Yeah, the issue of China's proliferation activities hasn't been raised, but China, as many of us know, gave nuclear technology to Pakistan in the 80s and 90s. That nuclear technology ended up going to Libya and Iran and North Korea, and they even found Chinese language nuclear warhead design documents when they dismantled Libya's nuclear program. Chinese companies since 2001 have been sanctioned more than 80 times, and they're doing this as part of a policy that's usually denied by the central government, but in reality, China is helping these rogue states with its with weapons technology, both missiles and weapons of mass destruction.
Thank you very much, Bill Gertz. And finally, on censorship.
Well, I'm against that, too. Thank you. On censorship, the quick answer is the Internet has changed China, and China is fighting a losing battle every day with information. You wouldn't believe what is on the blogs. Google handled it okay. Yahoo handled it terribly. What Google did is they had to be in that market. I'm glad they're in that market because they're pushing the envelope on freedom of information. And what they did is they labeled their searches that they're censored, which drove the Chinese government crazy. Yahoo, on the other hand, caved right in, gave them names of people that were using Yahoo email accounts. We have to be there. We have to be pushing for freedom of information. And it's happening. Let the Chinese people do it.
Jim McGregor, thank you very much. I know that many more of you have questions. I'm afraid we're not going to have time for them, but please feel free to maul our panelists after the debate. The final stage of this is that each of the panelists gets 2 minutes to sum up, and we start with State Roy. Yeah.
No, we're starting with Jim.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
It says Jim, but it says State, but go ahead. Jim McGregor.
Yeah, I don't really know what there is to add to this other than we really haven't been talking about the Chinese people at all. Why don't we give them a chance? The Chinese people are moving ahead very quickly. They are not idiots. They're very smart. They're pushing their government every day. We're trying to tell them you must be Democrats tomorrow. The last time they took a government system from the West, it was communism. They don't want another one of those. Give them the time to find their own way. You talk about the string of pearls strategy. The string of pearls strategy I see every day in the markets when people are bargaining for pearls. They don't want to come and attack America. They want to come here and go to Vegas. They want to go to Colorado skiing. They want to shop on Rodeo Drive. The Chinese are joining the world. This is not a country run by monsters who are out to take over the United States. They just want to be somebody in the world. And if we handle them with some skill and some sympathy, but also tough, where they are violating international rules like proliferation and intellectual property rights, the U.S. and China can have a very good relationship. I would just like to say, please, do not tell Secretary Gates that Mr. Pillsbury, who works at the Department of Defense, has asked you to vote against America tonight. America can handle China.
Thank you very much, Jim McGregor. Now, John Mearsheimer, for the motion.
Ambassador Roy made the point that Chinese leaders today don't think about dominating Asia. And I think he's correct. They don't. And the reason that they don't is because they do not have the wherewithal or anything near the wherewithal to think about dominating Asia. The question you have to ask yourself is how are the Chinese likely to think when they look something like the United States today, when they're really very, very powerful. To give you an analogy, it's like having money. I've gotten wealthier over time, which is not to say I've gotten wealthy, but I've gotten wealthier over time. I've accumulated more money. And I think about spending that money and doing things with that money in very different ways now that I have it than I did when I didn't have two nickels to rub together. And the point that I would make to you about China is that there's going to come a point in the story that we're telling up here where China is extremely powerful. And I think then it will begin to think about subjects like Taiwan very differently. Of course the Chinese don't want to pick a fight with the United States now over Taiwan. They know what would happen. They would get clobbered. But the question you have to ask yourself is, in a world where China has a huge navy, a much bigger and more efficient army, more missiles, right, and the United States is at a significant disadvantage in East Asia, which is a great distance away from this country, how do you think China will then think about Taiwan and the possibility of using threats? I'd bet a lot of money that they'll think very differently, and it won't be to our advantage.
John Mearsheimer, thank you very much. Now, against the motion, Daniel Rosen.
So much has been said. Two quick concluding points. Firstly, are we confident that our institutions, our way of going about growing an economy, spending our lives, is profoundly superior, better to the way China's organized, to the problems of China we've discussed this evening? I'm confident. And thus, I'm confident that for China to match us in terms of wealth creation, prosperity over time, they'll necessarily have to move in the direction of our institutions, our way of behaving in the world. I have no doubt about that. Secondly, the problems that are existential in nature, that really threaten our welfare today, are no longer realist in nature. Maybe unfortunately. The greatest force projection on planet Earth could not stop 9/11 from taking place in this city, could it? The challenges of global environmental change, climate change, cannot be addressed in any way whatsoever with force projection. We are in trouble already. Is there trouble down the road? There's trouble here today. The question is, what evolution of China best serves our interest in addressing those troubles and minimizing the trouble our children will have to deal with, we'll have to deal with for the rest of our careers? It seems abundantly clear to me that a China stronger, more prosperous, further down the road to democracy as well, is what we want to see as we turn to address all these problems which can no longer be dealt with just by the U.S. Navy. Thanks.
Daniel Rosen, thank you very much. And now for the motion, Michael Pillsbury.
Thank you. I forgot to quote from Nancy Pelosi a little bit earlier. Because you keep referring to us as the right, I thought perhaps you should hear a couple of sentences from the Speaker of the House of Representatives. She was attacking President Bush last April during the visit of Hu Jintao. She said that she opposed the celebratory nature of the official visit. She said our own debt with China is growing so fast, they'll soon be making our foreign policy. She said trickle-down liberty is not going to work. It's an illusion. She said that we should avoid wishful thinking about China ever being becoming a responsible stakeholder. She said our trade relationship with China has been a disaster. Despite more than a decade of concessions, the trade deficit with China has grown from $4 billion a year to more than $4 billion a week. China continues to manipulate its currency, making its exports cheaper and U.S. imports more expensive than they would be in a free market condition. If President Bush kowtows to Beijing in ways that threaten our long-standing commitment to Taiwan, members of both parties in Congress will be watching. She concluded by saying the American people want an administration to show resolve in standing up to Beijing. So all of you supporters in the audience of George Bush, be sure to vote for the other team.
You're going to vote with us then, right?
Because here is Nancy Pelosi rather articulately saying, beware of the dragon, the boom in China spells trouble for America.
An extraordinary intelligence squared moment there. Michael Pelosi. Michael Pillsbury channeling his inner Nancy Pelosi. Thank you very much. Stapleton Roy now going to channel, I don't know who, hopefully Stapleton Roy, finishing up against the motion.
Let's look at the process. China was outside the system 30 years ago. It favored proliferation. We have had trouble with China every stage of the process, but it's been moving toward becoming a more responsible part of the international community. It signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in 1992. It signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty 2 years later. It now cooperates with the Missile Technology Control Regime. We've sanctioned them in various ways at every stage of this process. China has improved, but it has been troublesome. So it's not easy to deal with China, but look at the trend. Look at Asia. Asia is the one country in the one region of the world where every authoritarian system that has gone through 30 to 40 years of rapid economic development, has stayed open to the outside world, has been embedded in the global economic system, and has had friendly relations with the United States, has moved from authoritarian systems of government to representative forms of government. No exceptions. South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, Indonesia. China's only part way along that. It's a strategic gamble. If China doesn't become wealthier, it's not going to become democratic. But if China becomes wealthier, it becomes more powerful. That's a challenge for our diplomacy. Are we up to it? You bet we are. We're good at it when we give ourselves a chance. We know how to use the right balance of power and influence, and if we get it right, China can be a more prosperous, friendly country to the United States. It's not going to run roughshod in its own neighborhood because it'll be slapped down by not just the United States. We don't have to deal with China alone. If we have good relations with Japan, with Russia, with India, and with the other countries of East Asia, China's not going to have the opportunity. That's our challenge. It's a good challenge. I say neither beware nor embrace the dragon. Be realistic and advance our own interests intelligently.
Stapleton Roy, your time. Thank you very much. And finally, for the motion, Bill Gertz.
Yes, thank you. I want to thank the Intelligence Squared for this debate. I think it's a very important debate. And the debate we're having tonight, I think, is reflective of a debate that's currently going on at the highest levels of the U.S. government. And that debate can be characterized on the one side, you have Condoleezza Rice going to Beijing shortly before she became Secretary of State and said, we want a strong China. On the other side of the debate are people in the national security community, the Pentagon, who say, wait a minute, there are so many unknowns about China. We don't know what takes place. We don't know. When we have all of these military exchanges that Mike Pillsbury talks about, one of the first questions is, what is the extent of the military buildup of China? The Chinese will not answer. When you combine that with China's use of deception, that is deliberate strategic misinformation to misguide us, we know very little about it. Therefore, it is dangerous, in my view, that we should want to see a strong China, and that really we have to keep our powder dry until we can find out what goes on in the inner councils of the Chinese system. And for that reason, I urge you to vote for the motion tonight.
Bill Gertz, thank you very much. Well, that brings to an end the talking, and now for the action. We return to these crazy contraptions, your voting pads. Please pick them up again, and let's see if I can get it right this time. Could you, in voting, press 1 if you're for the motion, 2 if you're against the motion, and 3 if you're still undecided? So could you cast your vote now? Michael Pillsbury has just told me that it's like American Idol. I'm not sure on that basis who will win. exactly. Now, before I tell you the results of the vote, I just want to take care of a couple of things. Firstly, I'd like to thank our panel of debaters, Stapleton Roy, Daniel Rosen, Jim McGregor, Michael Pillsbury, John Mearsheimer, and Bill Gertz. Thank you very much indeed. I also would like to thank you, the audience, for your thoughtful engagement here this evening. Don't need to give yourself another round of applause. That was more than good enough. But then, of course, I'd really like to thank Intelligence Squared, which has brought this, the eighth and final debate of this season, here to the US. It's been an extraordinary success and brought really substantive and complicated issues to be debated and be discussed in what I hope you'll agree is a very engaging and thought-provoking way. You will, of course, be hungering for the next debate, and it is spreading democracy in the Middle East is a bad idea. That will be held on Tuesday, September the 18th. Spreading democracy in the Middle East is a bad idea. Before you maul our panelists, you may want to rush out and get tickets for the fall season. And while I'm doing the plugs, let me tell you that if you want to go and listen to this whole thing all over again, you certainly should do on WNYC AM 820 on Friday, May the 25th at 7 in the evening. And we're very much appreciate the support from them. And again, there are copies of books by Bill Gertz and Jim McGregor, you know, which are for sale upstairs. And there are also DVDs of previous debates available from Intelligence Squared. While I'm about it, I should tell you they're copies of the Times of London newspaper upstairs, so pick one of those up. They have the glorious advantage of being free this evening for you. Now, finally, let's get to business. What are the results of the debate? Now, let me remind you where you stood before the debate. 41% were for the motion, and just so I do this properly, beware the dragon, a booming China spells trouble for America. Before the debate, 41% for the motion, 37% against the motion, 21% undecided. After the debate, 35% for the motion, 58.6% against the motion, 6.1% undecided. The team against the motion wins. Thank you very much indeed.